I call the House Education Finance Committee to order. Good morning, everybody. I hope you all had a safe drive-in. I love anti-lock brakes. That's all I can say. All right. So first item on the agenda is the minutes. Representative Pryor is here via remote with the permission from the Speaker of the House in accordance to the House rules. Just want to note that. With that, Representative Jordan, have you had a chance to look at the minutes?
Yes, Madam Chair. I have examined the minutes from March 21st, and I would make a motion for their approval.
Representative Jordan makes a motion to move the minutes for March 21st. Are there any questions on the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed say no. The minutes for March 21st are adopted. Members, we have some bonding bills before us today for informational hearings. Some of these are in the governor's bonding proposal, and others are from our members. So we will start with those. There'll be no action taken. With that, we'll actually start with the governor's capital budget recommendations. And we have a slideshow up and Mr. Uni to present. So please state your name for the record and proceed.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Ado Shuni. I'm the Director of Government Relations for the Minnesota Department of Education. And today I'll be providing an overview of the governor's capital budget recommendations on library construction grants. So the first slide is just to start by providing the committee with the context for libraries in Minnesota and the importance that they play for all of our communities around the state. We have 12 regional public library systems, which you can see on the map up here. There are 359 public library locations around the state in 8 bookmobiles, and there's at least one public library in each of Minnesota's 87 counties. So what does usage look like in total? In 2022, this is what these numbers are for, 3.2 million registered public library users. That was nearly half of Minnesota that had a public library card. 53 million items were borrowed or downloaded, and there were over 100,000 community meetings held at public libraries in the state. Also in 2022, there were 3.5 million visits to public libraries. So to put that in context for the importance to Minnesotans, in the same year, there were 16.8 million visits to Disneyland, 14.9 million visits to the Smithsonian, 11.9 million visits to Minnesota State Parks and Trails, and 4.3 million visits to Minnesota Professional Sports home games. The Public Library Construction Grant Program, and that's under Minnesota Statute 134.45, allows cities, counties, and regional public library systems to apply for grants to fund improvement or accessibility projects. Improvement projects with a maximum award of $1 million include new construction, renovation of existing library facilities, repair of existing library facilities, and an example of this is featured on this slide. This is Kimball Public Library, which was a 2019 grantee. They received $440,000 in that year, and this increased their square footage for a new facility, and increased their overall square footage from just over 1,000 square feet to 4,200 square feet. Accessibility projects are a maximum award of $450,000. This includes remediation of public physical barriers that prevent access for all, automatic doors, ADA compliant restrooms, and upgraded lighting. These library construction projects require improvement or accessibility projects require a local match of 50% of the total cost, and MDE runs these grants as a competitive peer-reviewed process. Our 2024 recommendation is $1 million, and the history of this program has been a long-running one. This has been since 1994 until 2023, so last year. This has been funded 13 total times over that time period. The last two allocations were $2.95 million in 2020, and then last year was $4 million. The appropriations have ranged from $1 million to $4 million. And since the inception of the Library Construction Grant Program, the state has made 170 awards total. Libraries in 70 of the 87 counties have applied for and received grants. 40 of the projects have been in the seven-county metro area, and 130 projects have been in greater Minnesota. I think I may have skipped a slide here. My apologies. You can see on this statewide, on this map, you can see the statewide spread of the projects that have been awarded since 1994. All around, again, 70 counties out of the 87 have received projects or have received funding for their projects. The average award is almost $108,000. The largest was $1 million to Fergus Falls in 2018, and that was an improvement project. The smallest was $614, and that was in 1996 for a project in White Bear Lake. And as you can see at the bottom of the slide, the average local match has been $6.27 from local investment for every state dollar that has been provided. Yeah, I'm sorry, these slides are a little bit mixed up. My apologies. Over 2024, again, as I mentioned, our recommendation is $1 million. I apologize, I'm a little bit thrown off here because my slides are not in order from what I originally had them. As I had mentioned before, there's 17.8 million dollars in grant funds. This has drawn in local support. I had mentioned $1 to every six of state funds to every $6.27 in local funds. This has drawn nearly $112 million in local support. And as you can see here, we've got a list of prospective cities and prospective counties that we would believe would be eligible applicants for this next or could be eligible applicants for this next round. And how we analyze whether there's prospective clients is simply people reaching out and inquiring if there's new rounds of funds that are going to be available. This program, as I mentioned, has been around since 1994, so the community of people who would be eligible for these grants are pretty familiar with the opportunity, so we get pretty regular outreach from our prospective grantees. The current unmet need is $194 million statewide. This is collected by the Council of Regional Library Systems and Administrators. We just got this data, I think, about a week and a half ago or 2 weeks ago. They usually get this done end of February, beginning of March. So this is a significant increase from what we had seen before. I think it was somewhere around like $90 or $100 million in this. We've seen that the need has gone up. Just for the community to know, that, as I mentioned, there's $4 million was for the library construction grants from last year. We are currently, the process is currently open right now, and that the opportunity will be closing, I believe, sometime in mid-May. So I think it's like 2.5 months that the opportunity is going to be open for. With that, Madam Chair, that concludes my presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Uni. And members, you should see there's a chart in the packet, and then the slides for the next few presentations are all combined as well. Next up, we have, any questions for Mr. Uni before we go over the next two testifiers? Seeing none, I have Dr. Charles Rick, Executive Director from the Perkins Center for the Arts, on remote. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Charles Rick. I'm Executive Director of the Perkins Center for Arts Education. And today I'm just going to refer to my slides that I have that you should have in front of you also. And I'm going to do a brief overview of those slides and take any questions you may have. I'm going to begin on really the slide number four. Just to highlight that the Perkins Center serves a unique role as a state agency. Now, we have students from all over the state, including 36 of 87 counties, 91 school districts, and all 8 congressional districts. And our graduation rate since 2021 has been 100%. Also, another leg of Perkins is the professional development resource programs. And you can see on the slide where I have, we have drawn a map and it shows all the different access points that PDR has been out to in the past year, serving over 211 school districts and charter schools and connecting with educators in all 67 Minnesota Senate districts. Also, we have a arts library located in the main building on campus. and this is accessible to any resident in Minnesota, and they have a wide-ranging catalog of resources and extensive art education resources as well. I'm going to go on to the next slide. This is awards and news. This is just a slide that we're proud of to recognize students for their achievements during the current school year. You can see on there we have students getting different awards, both scholastically and artistically. We, in our professional development resource program, we focused on the Native Author Series this year. We've also focused on outreach for Tier 1 and 2 tier art educators and media arts educator cohort. And then again, our library continues to build a collection of Native authors and with a focus on Dakota and Ojibwe authors. The next slide is titled Asset Preservation Overview. And I'm going to explain more about this as we go through the coming slides. But overall, it's to preserve the existing infrastructure, reflect our strategic plan, potential budget savings, energy savings costs, and eliminate repair costs. And our previous asset preservation amounts are listed there below, which I'm going to highlight now. In 2020, we, with the remaining dollars that are available, we plan to replace and repair road surface and parking lot areas and any sidewalks that were not repaired 2 years ago. Last year, you would have seen on here too, also the high school parking lot, but with the mini roundabout on Highway 55 and Douglas Drive, which I know some of you who were out there in June saw what was taking place. As part of the projects for Golden Valley, they paved, redid the parking lot for Perpich. And then the next slide is 2023 appropriations of $891,000. And priority one is to replace the roof on the Gaia building, which is one of the buildings on the property at Perpich, and also to replace and repair exterior precast concrete panels. And the concrete precast panels are part of the veneer, not the structure, like brick or metal panels on your other buildings. It's just important from an envelope perspective and not structural, and we'll know more once a consultant is hired. The next slide is just a picture of our capital budget request of $4 million for this year. You can see on there the chart that we put on there for you to look at. The governor's recommendation was $1.623 million in asset preservation funds, which is not $4 million. So where are we going to spend those dollars? We've had a project on this list in the last 5 years and longer since I've been there at Perpich. And so the next slide we're going to go on to is asset preservation capital projects. And for the using the funds from the governor's recommendation, we are going to repair and upgrade our restroom updates. There was a study done in 2016, and there are building code violations, there are issues. We have ADA compliance issues, we have fixtures that need to be replaced and added to. And so that is the main focus of the priority for the $1.623 million. And the project of the 1.6 would include, on the following slide, 2024 recommendations. With those dollars, once they become available, we would work with the state in hiring a consultant, which could begin as early as July of this year. And then once the analysis is done, the next step would be to obtain approval for the project and then establish a timeline. And we do need to keep in mind, because we have students there from mid-August to the end of May, looking like June of 2023 might be a good time to start the project. And so, as stated earlier, the project includes updating restroom facilities, including the plumbing system and fixtures to address ADA concerns in the main building. And we would continue on with other dollars when they become available to look at the guideline and the residence dorm. And then also, just as a reminder, if the roof replacement project exceeds the estimate of $891,000, we would then use dollars from the 2024 money available to finish the project. And then also I did have slides in there on the school billion work redesign that we've asked for in the past. And so right now I'm not going to talk about that because the main focus here is asset preservation funds. And at this time, that concludes my presentation, and I will take any questions or comments.
Thank you, Dr. Reck, and thank you for mentioning our trip out there in June for the committee. Not all members were able to make it, but folks got to see the need that you have. Members, are there any questions at the table for Ms. Dr. Reck? Nope. All right. We will move on then with Terry Weidling, superintendent for Minnesota State Academies, who is also on remote. Please state your name for the record and proceed. And good morning.
Yes, hi. Just one moment. Hello. My name is Terry Wilding. I am superintendent of the Minnesota State Academies for the Deaf and Blind in Faribault, Minnesota. Thank you for your time this morning. I would like to start with a little bit of an overview of our programming for both schools, and some of you might not be familiar with our programming. Who we are. We are one of two schools under the state. I serve two schools, excuse me, one for the deaf and one for the blind in Faribault. We were established in 1858, and we are one of the oldest public schools in the state of Minnesota. We serve a variety of students and needs. Most of them are deaf, blind, with additional disabilities and challenges. We serve students from birth to age 22. We are special ed compliant. We provide different services. Our students come from all over the state of Minnesota. We have 50 to 60 school districts that we work with on a yearly basis, sometimes more, sometimes less. We also provide support for families, parents, and school districts as part of our mission to serve the state of Minnesota. We have two schools, like I mentioned, one for blind and visually impaired students, and then one for deaf and hard of hearing students. And also we have some deafblind students that are served on both campuses. Often our students go to both campuses depending on their service requirements and what they need. 60% of our students commute. They go home on a daily basis, and 40% of our students stay in our dorm facilities during the week and go home on the weekends, largely due to the distance of their homes from our school. All of our students are special ed, have special ed services, meaning they are on IEPs or IFSPs. We have different specialty services that we provide to each student to meet all of their needs. Not only deaf and blind, but many of our students have additional physical, mental, emotional challenges that we provide support for. All of our teachers have special ed licenses through PELSB for deaf and hard of hearing or BVI requirements. We also receive training and development to meet certain requirements for our students. We provide class instruction and services for students, as well as providing resources and education tools and strategies and training for other school districts, families, and parents statewide. Our dorm programming is optional for students who live far. They can stay, and we provide instruction on social-emotional learning, also addressing different independent living skills in the dorms in the evenings. We are funded in a unique way compared to most public schools in Minnesota. Our construction and AP monies, we are not able to do levies. It's just like perpage. We have no way for us to collect additional monies. So we are fully dependent on legislative support and allocations for our renovations, our buildings, and our maintenance needs. This year, we have three requests two are pre-design projects plus an asset preservation. The first pre-design program and project is looking at funding for a center on our Duff campus. We have some really old buildings that are in poor or actual crisis condition. We want to look at how to replace those buildings with a new student center to cover our athletics, our PE facilities, our cafeteria, and our tech education center. For our transition program, we hope that this design for our new building will save us a lot of money in maintenance and energy costs, as well as staffing and other needs, really reducing our square footage and helping us to be more efficient. Our current buildings are over 75 to 100 years old, and it is really time to look at replacing instead of really putting in a lot of money to maintain and preserve these buildings. This project is critical as most of our buildings are not accessible. We are having more students who have physical challenges needing wheelchairs and other accessibility needs that our buildings cannot provide. They are not meeting current safety or ADA codes at this time. We hope to design a better building that is more user-friendly and more accessible and safe for our students and families. The second pre-design money that we are requesting is related to a therapy pool and spa hot tub at the Blind School campus. We currently have a therapy pool and spa there, but it is not for recreation or enjoyment. The purpose is therapy. There are blind students who also have physical challenges, which means that they are seated in a wheelchair on a daily basis all day and their body becomes stiff and it's hard for them to move and hard for them to then learn and attend to their education. This allows them to warm up their bodies, to stretch as needed, and get back to their learning. So the pool is over 50 years old currently. We're starting to notice there's some sufficient costs to us. For the last 4 years, we've had three separate projects trying to fix and maintain that pool, and we've realized it is time to replace that pool. And there is only one lift in the pool for students from wheelchairs to get them into the water, and sometimes that's a challenge and it slows down and consumes a lot of time trying to get students in and out of that pool. A different design would be a walk-in or a wheelchair accessible pool for the therapy to ensure safety getting in and out of the pool. This will help us design a safe space for our students. The project is critical because it can, like I mentioned, our students face physical challenges, and this will be helpful for them to ensure their learning. Repairing it has become non-cost effective, so hoping this new pool design will reduce that burden on our maintenance staff and our budget. The last project request we are asking for this year is asset preservation funding. Every year we ask for funding to maintain a safe and accessible campus. This is an ongoing process. We have a variety of projects. Like I mentioned, our school is very old and our buildings are a challenge to maintain. We have two buildings on the historical registry, which means it becomes more complex to care for and maintain these buildings. We hope to receive ongoing funding to pursue different projects such as sidewalks, external buildings, walls, doors, asbestos abatement, accessibility, bathroom upgrades, and what have you. We've decided projects on safety needs, accessibility program needs, and that's how we decide the priority for those. So these projects are ongoing, and we do have phases depending on the budget available to us at the time. Like I mentioned, most of our buildings are very old. They are pre-ADA, and it is an ongoing process to keep them updated and maintained. We are also looking at safety and security more these days. We have a very vulnerable group of students. Some of them are very young. Some of them have cognitive challenges or language delays. We want to make sure our campus is safe and parents trust us with their children. Last, I will wrap up with future projects. Some of you have visited our campus last fall. We do have a library on the Blind Campus that was running and funded by MDE, Minnesota Department of Education. That library left us technically and moved to a new MDE building in Minneapolis. So now we have a vacant building on our campus. Unfortunately, that building does not meet our current student needs. It is not designed appropriately, and it does have asbestos in the flooring. There does need to be some work done on that building. This is not included in the government proposal this year, but I wanted to put it on your radar for future projects. We will need to renovate that building at some point so it becomes more user-friendly to us. Possibly we can take down another building on campus as well. We are hoping that that building will be able to be included in our future projects. So that is my summary. If there are any questions, please let me know.
Thank you, Superintendent Wadling. Questions at the table? I see Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question concerning that library issue that was just mentioned. Does the academy then have a current working library on campus?
Superintendent Wadling.
So we do have a library on the deaf campus, and it is for our deaf students. We currently do not have a library at the blind school campus, and we will be working with MDE's Talkbook and Braille library. They are able to send books to us for our students when we need, but we are hoping to have a small library on our campus in that building when we are able to complete renovations.
Representative Bennett, follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that. I think it's really important to have a library for both the blind and the deaf, and so I would hope that those things move forward and we can support that as a state. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Bennett. Any further questions or comments from members? Thank you, Dr. Wadling, for being with us today. Next up, we're going to move to a few member bills.
Thank you.
Next up, we're going to move to a few member bills. We have House File 2069 here with Representative Rarick. And this is an informational hearing, so I don't think I have to move it in front of us. So go ahead, and start your presentation, Representative Rarick. Welcome to the Education Finance Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for getting my name correct. It's been a challenge. Thank you so much. I'm so glad everyone's here and made it through the snow safely. Thank you, Chair, and thank you, members, for hearing our bill today. And it's regarding the Wright Technical Center in Buffalo. It's the right in the center of Wright County. This is a $9.5 million ask to literally save this building. They've got critical infrastructure needs. If you take this out, so you should have this in your packet. The very first thing you'll notice is it says the last surviving vocational cooperative in the state of Minnesota. So these cooperatives started in 1972, and this is the last one that's still standing. It's the only vocational cooperative in the entire state of Minnesota that is still left. This cooperative serves 8 school districts and 804 students currently. They do not have levy authority. I need to say that again, because they do not have levy authority because of the way that they are structured. That is why they find themselves in this precarious situation. With that, I'm going to let you know what that precarious situation is with my testifier. But he's going to go through some of this, and as you open this up, it has all the detail of what is critical and what they need for the $9.5 million. So, Madam Chair, thank you so much for having me here today, and I'll turn it over to my testifier.
Great. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Brian Koslovsky, Executive Director of the Red Technical Center in Buffalo. Madam Chair and committee members, good morning, and thank you very much for the opportunity to present as far as the critical needs of our facility and the importance of our district. With our 51st year as a vocational cooperative, having served over 30,000 students in advanced career and technical training since 1972, we're at a position to where the needs of the facility and meeting the needs of those students that we currently serve of the 8-member districts is met. We also house the Wright Learning Academy, which is the ALC. So when we think about the skilled trades and the opportunities to receive training, you know, thinking back to the pandemic, the trades were the only area that continued that were considered to be essential. And so currently this year, with 720 students that are partaking in those advanced career and technical opportunities from health science, law enforcement, EMR, auto careers, auto tech, construction, welding, on-the-job training, youth apprenticeship, heavy equipment operations and maintenance, early childhood elementary careers, where we're providing those training opportunities for future daycare providers or elementary teachers, we're at a critical need to where to meet in order to continue to meet those students' needs based on our facilities. As a vocational cooperative, as was stated earlier, Wright Technical Center has no levy authority, and we rely on our 8-member districts to levy for us on our behalf. The financial positions of our member districts isn't such to where they can provide us any additional funding to meet our needs based on their struggling as well. Hard freezes of program supplies budgets have been implemented the last 3 to 4 years, where, for example, the health science students having to simulate putting on gloves and taking off gloves because the supplies budgets are not meeting the needs of the students and the instructors in order to provide the critical needs for those classes. Custodial staff has been reduced, where administration is left to pick up the pieces in which we do whatever it is that is needed. The FY23 audit revealed a deficit spending of -1.67 below the fund balance as a negative number, and at a -2.5 will trigger a statutory operating debt. The ongoing facility needs have exhausted the fund balance. Wright Tech Center has only received long-term facility maintenance dollars for the past 7 years. So as a 43-year-old building then, the needs of the facility were such that the fund balance has now been depleted. A minor $170,000 tuck pointing project turned into a $1.1 million wall restoration project, which saved a major catastrophe. And due to the fund balance being depleted, we're just not able to continue to meet the needs of the other facilities. When we think about rooftop units, temperature control upgrade, parking lots, sidewalks, lighting and flooring replacement, the never-ending cycle. And we have had a rooftop unit now that has been inoperable since January 29th. We're just thankful for the warm winter where we have been able to keep the lights on and keep everything operating as such. Without the necessary funds to improve the programming, we'll continue to suffer in order to also stay current with what industry expects and demands. The proposed maintenance, repairs, and capital improvements are essential to address also safety concerns with safe and secure entrances. We also have a cosmetology building that is in a secondary building. The students in that program have to actually walk through the alley, enter the building through an auto tech shop, out and over into the hallways in order to use restrooms. With the rise in the costs associated with maintaining the 85,000 square foot facility, the funds just aren't enough, and we are really in desperate situation in order to meet our facility needs. The funding is necessary in order to restore critical facility components. And thank you so much for your consideration.
Thank you so much. sorry, I was taking notes about all the amazing programs that you have at the Tech Center. Thank you so much, Superintendent. With that, members, our Executive Director. With that, members, are there any questions or comments? Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative, for this bill and presenting it. So 50 years, you've brought 30,000 students, so you're looking at like 600 students a year. Do you know how many of them are actually going into the fields that you're teaching them in?
Executive Director.
Madam Chair and Representative, the challenge in tracking that data is just that there are 8-member districts, but we do know that there are several critical needs that are being met by the trades that are being offered with the students that are receiving training. We provide the certification. We have trainings. We have articulated agreements with 27 post-secondary institutions where students are either going on to industry or, onto post-secondary, or our mission and goals are to provide that level of training where the students are able to enter right into the workforce if they so choose.
Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And can you just give us an example? I don't see on the flyer, like just an example of some of the jobs and industries that they would go into.
Oh, certainly.
Executive Director.
Madam Chair and Representative, the welding program is probably our most popular. We have 60 students in the program, and last year we had 56 students on the wait list. And we have a very diverse group of young students, both women and men, that are in the welding technology program. Mm-hmm. And I know that the one is currently working at Galbrand, and one is attending Ridgewater College under a scholarship. She actually won a first place competition at a welding competition at Ridgewater last year. Our auto tech program, we have students that are working at Ryan Chevrolet, and with youth apprentice programs, we have close to 50 students that are currently involved in youth apprenticeships, and over 100 students that are currently working on the job training. We are new heavy equipment and operations maintenance program. 7 of those 22 students in its inaugural year passed the Ramsey test for entrance into the training site in Hinckley for the local 49ers as the heavy equipment. And currently one of those students is actually working at Vite. And so there's other examples as well with the opportunities that our students have. So, thank you.
Just one more.
I was just one more question,
Madam Chair, and then thank you. That's very helpful. And then I see that the Chambers of Commerce are on here. Are you partnering with local businesses then?
Executive Director.
Madam Chair and Representative, Wright Technical Center is a member of all of the 13 communities that are within members of the Wright Technical Center, and we are partners with I'm over 150 industry partners that we are represented by as we provide those advanced career training opportunities for them as well.
Thank you. Representative Bennett.
Thanks, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Rarick, and I'm sorry, I forgot your name, but anyway, for the great presentation. I just had a question and kind of a comment, too, because vocational education is so critical, and we don't have enough really opportunities around the state for that, so appreciate the work in this. And I know with special education cooperatives, which I have one kind of near my district, they're in a similar situation, I think, funded. I guess that's kind of my question, is I'm thinking the funding is similar to how this is, where you do not have levity authority on your own. Those surrounding school districts basically fund your school. And I know I've spoken with the cooperatives in my area, and they struggle with the same issues of not being able to have levy authority for their building needs. And so is that true then? You don't have levy authority similar to these special ed co-ops? I guess that's my first question.
I'll go to Executive Director Kozlowski and then to Mr. Strong. Go ahead.
Yes, Madam Chair and Representative. Yes, we are the only vocational cooperative. There are the four intermediate districts. There are special ed cooperatives. And three of those four actually are held on college campuses with their programs. And they are charged a lease. And so that's likely through the lease levy that the member districts of supporting those institutions are paying that rent. So with the intermediate districts being special ed districts and including the Wright Technical Center as the vocational cooperative, we do not have levy authority.
Mr. Strong, would you like to add to that?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Bennett, one other factor to consider is in the special education, there is a bill back process as well. So with the vocational portions of the program at Wright Technical Center, there's no bill back for any kind of cost associated with facilities. So in addition to the levy authority the executive director mentioned, that's another difference between them as well. There are a number of different types of structures. There are some education districts, the intermediate districts, interestingly enough, 50 years ago were primarily for vocational education, and their mission has changed fairly substantially over time. But Wright Technical Center is quite alone in terms of its structure as primarily a vocational cooperative and no ability to bill back facility costs.
Representative Phillips.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you. And I think this is a worthy project, and you're kind of between a rock and a hard place on how to fund these needs, and you're providing a great service for vocational skills and jobs for our state. So I do hope it'll be included in the bonding bill. Thanks.
Thank you. With that, members, I think we'll move on to the next. Oops, I forgot any final words. We were doing informational, so I forgot to switch back to you. So go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, so much. So I would just really appreciate your support. You can now see that they are very unique in the education sphere of things. They're literally, as Representative Bennett said, between a rock and a hard place. I'd hate for them to have to close, and they're right on the verge, because they're already doing deficit spending, which you know they cannot sustain. So we're at a critical juncture, and I would love your support. And I've even, with my husband, the senator, climbed up on the roof and looked at their roof and their infrastructure. And the senator, who's also an electrician, opened up the panels to look at the electrical panels and was aghast. So they definitely need our support and our help to survive. So I really appreciate this, Chair, and thank you so much for giving us time today.
No problem. Thank you, Representative Barrick, and have a safe trip back.
Thank you.
With that, members, we'll go to House File 3295 and Representative Weiner. Another informational hearing on a bonding bill from one of our members. Once you get settled in, you can go ahead and Representative Weiner, start your presentation. Maybe we can pull another chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Thanks for hearing my bill, House File 3295, $7.8 million bonding request for Browerville Public Schools. Browerville has a population of about 900 residents. It's in Todd County in my area. And on April 1st last year, heavy snows and ice partially collapsed the high school gym. This natural disaster is a challenge for the school and community, but the biggest reason that we're here is this is such a unique situation. If this had been a tornado or a storm, and declared an emergency, there would have been monies made available. But because, or if this had been an expansion, the school would have gone through the bonding process and would have taken care of that themselves. But because of this unique situation, they kind of fall through the cracks. And that's the reason for this ask today, because in a normal process, we would have had means and funds available. But because it's so unique, it is kind of excluded. So with that, I'll turn it over to my testifiers, Superintendent Scott, and one of our teachers, Christine Johnson.
Thank you. Go ahead and state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you, Representative Weiner, for the opportunity to testify today. Representative Weiner made it clear that on April 1st, which is almost its one-year anniversary, and this past week, we have a celebration in our community where we have an annual ham dinner, and it actually took place on the day of the collapse last year. So I did not have the opportunity to work at it, but this year I had the opportunity, and I actually didn't have the opportunity to work because I actually spent time describing what happened 1 year ago. So it was a kind of a bittersweet event yesterday. As Representative Weiner said, on April 1st, I got a phone call from my track coach, who happened to walk into the gymnasium to leave for a track meet. And as he walked in, one of our track athletes picked up a basketball to shoot a jump shot. And he's not a very good basketball player, but even he realized that the basket was not at 10 feet, it was at about 8 feet. The gym had partially collapsed and was sagging in the middle. He immediately removed those athletes from the building and contacted me. We immediately contacted structural engineers and went through the process. Within 4 hours, there was a team of individuals from Minneapolis and throughout the state on site. And within a short story, within 22 hours, we brought that building down safely because it was deemed unsafe. And when you talk to people and you talk to insurance companies, they give you two words, preserve and protect. So what does that mean? To preserve and protect the rest of the building. So we had to disconnect all the water, all the glycol, all the electricity, everything that would protect the rest of the building in case that building collapsed. If we wouldn't have done that, four major water mains itself feeding the gymnasium would have torn apart the rest of the building and emptied 1 million gallons of water into the school from our water tower. So those are the things that people don't understand, what went on within 22 hours when we tore that building down. Once that happens, we no longer have a gym. And when people think of a gym, it's not just for basketball, it's not just for volleyball, it's also our classrooms, okay? We not only lost classrooms, but we also lost 13 other classrooms surrounding that to make sure that the structure was safe for over 2 weeks, okay? Following that, we had to then make preparation. Where are we going to hold classes? Where are we going to hold sporting events? Where are we going to hold all the activities that happen in that facility? A facility that is used 355 days out of 365 days a year. Okay? Well, fortunately and unfortunately, we were the kind of blessed, but the Eagle Valley School District became the first school district to dissolve in the state of Minnesota 6 years ago, and Browerville Public Schools inherited that school district. However, we gave that school back to the city of Clarissa. The city of Clarissa sold the building. So through process, I was able to lease that building back. So for the last year, we've been able to lease the gymnasium back. However, I have to transport children 6 miles to class every day, every period, just to make sure that we get that educational opportunity. Okay? This last fall, those two communities, neighboring communities, joined together and saw the need and passed our bond to successfully build a new gymnasium on a 60-40 vote, which is outstanding considering the fact that we live in one of the two poorest counties in the state of Minnesota. To do that, people extended themselves beyond their means and beyond what they can do. But they also know what the school district means to them and what it means to their communities. So we're here today to ask for your support, to help them, to help our communities, because as of right now, we have only captured half of that bond with the anticipation that the legislature would possibly help us with the other half. So with that, Mrs. Johnson.
Madam Chair and the committee, my name is Christine Johnson. I am a second grade teacher in Browerville, and I want to thank you guys for letting us come here and share our story with you today. And I also want to thank Representative Weiner for setting this meeting up with all of you today. So I'm here just to tell you a little bit about what it's like being a teacher, and for the students and the staff and the community, what has happened to our daily life in the school without having a gym. You know, I think until you don't have a gym, you really don't realize how much you use that gym. So for an example, we have programs. We have different programs that come in and for our students. There's no place to do the program because if our gym is available, our high school students are using it. So we're not able to have certain programs. Our concerts, you know, we have all of our concerts in our high school gym because our elementary gym is not large enough. Where do you hold the concert? So we've had to, you know, change that up. And, you know, it's hard for parents. Sometimes we're in the Long Prairie Auditorium using their place for a concert. Then we're in Clarissa using their gym. So things like that were really difficult. We're adjusting, and we're doing the best we can. A big part of our elementary was our grandparents' day. We'd have our grandparents come in and eat lunch with the students. We cannot do that anymore because we don't have the place to put everybody. Graduation. Our students couldn't go through graduation in our gym this year. Prom had to be moved. So there's a lot of adjustments we had to make without this gym. And I think until you do not have a gym, you don't really realize how important that gym is. As Mr. Bedbratton had said, all of our home events for volleyball, for basketball, they couldn't be in our gym. You know, and so seniors, they did not get to play their games, their senior year games in our gym. And we were very blessed to have a gym 6 miles down the road, but it was still, I hate to say it, an inconvenience. But you have to make do with what you have. And then for our community, if our community members wanted to use the gym for something, whether it be like a 4-H program or a Boy Scouts or Girl Scouts meeting, they weren't able to use it. We have many traveling teams for our elementary students. And those parents, they would be having practice for third graders at 7 o'clock at night because there were no gyms available. So it's just been an adjustment. We're doing the very best we can. And children are, they're amazing. They can go with it so much better than adults can. But we're doing our best, but we would love the support of all of you. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Superintendent. You had something else to add?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, one of the biggest questions that I'm asked is, what about insurance? And insurance covers the building for what it was, okay? It does not bring you back to code. And insurance loves to tell you and to throw things into categories. And to bring things to code, according to the Department of Ed, and to all the different building codes in today's world, I can't do that on what the insurance company gave us. Originally, when the insurance company came back, they gave me a total estimate that I could rebuild my building for $2.4 million. Okay, that is an unrealistic number. We got that number up to $5 million, and I still can't build it for that. The total number of the bill is $21 million, $16 million in bonding, $5 million in insurance. By doing that, that will bring our gyms back up to handicap accessibility. We had locker rooms that were downstairs. Those locker rooms will be handicap accessible. There'll be gender neutral bathrooms. All those kinds of new requirements will be addressed in the new structure. So I know that there's a lot of questions that usually ask me about insurance, but I promise you I'm not an expert on insurance, but I'm pretty good at it now. So
thank you, Superintendent. It's probably something you never thought you'd need to learn in your job, but
it's never a day that's identical in our lives.
Thank you. Members, I'll bring it to the table for questions or comments before I Representative Vernick, then Representative Vernick.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Rep. Wiener, for bringing this forward, because this isn't the first time we've heard about roofs in this committee, and I'm a big fan of looking at our critical infrastructure needs, so I appreciate you bringing it forward to highlight just how important not only are our teachers and our staff, but also the spaces in which our students go to learn and our staff go to work, and the impact that they have, as stated, Grandparents' Day, graduation, prom. So I wish you all the best as you move forward with this bonding project.
Thank you. And then Representative Bennett, then we'll have Representative Wiener wrap it up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry to talk so much, but these are such unique projects here. Wow. I do have a question for Ms. Johnson, but before I do, I'll just say I'm a former first grade teacher of many years, and I can't imagine when that happened, like being one of those classrooms that were disrupted and you suddenly have to move your entire classroom during the school year. That would be really tough. So my question is, I wasn't sure if I'm understanding this correctly on how your day works with the situation with the gym. Do you transport, so you're for your students, daily gym classes, or some schools do it three times a week, however, do you have to transport them then during the day to this other gym?
So, Madam Teacher?
Yeah.
Madam Chair and Representative, so our high school are the only students being transferred by bus right now to, they will go to the Clarissa gym. So our elementary students, we do have gym or Fayette every day, and right now we get the gym during our recess time. They do not transport the K through 6 children.
Representative Pena.
Thanks, Madam Chair, and thank you for that. And I guess whatever grade or age level is impacted like that, that's huge, because I know as a teacher, every minute of instructional time is huge. And if you're taking however many minutes it takes to travel back and forth, that's a huge chunk of educational time. So I used the verbiage between a rock and a hard place with the last project. I think you are between a rock and a hard place too. And thank you, Representative Weiner, for bringing this forward.
Thank you. And Representative Edelson, you had your hand up as well.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick, so it's the high school gym. Okay, I just was like trying to, then could you just clarify, Superintendent, again, you said you didn't get bonding. I mean, I guess it was at the end of last session. So you there was no bonding, right? Okay, that's, I just needed clarification on that. So perfect, thank you.
Superintendent.
Madam Chair, Representative, we did approach the legislature last year. However, timing is everything, and if the gym would have collapsed a week earlier, it would have been a different story, because you had just received all your target numbers a week earlier, so we were unable to do that.
Okay. Any other follow-up or comments, Representative Perzig?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Weiner, for bringing this. I just want to highlight, like, the major impact that these kids have had just within COVID and missing schools, and then how communal this space is, even for just the community engagement. We think about our Greater Minnesota students. We think about what captures, you know, their self-esteem, is those events, is those arts and theater spaces for not just the high school students, but the whole community in general. So thank you for bringing this bill forward, and I do look forward to seeing if we can get some support for you guys. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Vega. And Representative Weiner, final comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee. And once again, I'd really like to emphasize the uniqueness of this. If this was an expansion of the school, it would not be before you. If this was a storm, if this was a tornado, there'd be funding available for this. But because this is one of those anomalies, this is one of those things that falls between the crack, we've got a community here that's struggling, that are doing everything they can to give those kids the best education that they can. And, you know, I thank them for being down here today. Thanks for traveling through this rough weather. Thank you for the committee for hearing this, and hopefully we can get this into the Capital Investment Committee. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Weiner, and please have a safe travels back.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
With that, next up, we have Representative Knorr for House File 5078. Representative Knorr, welcome to the Education Finance Committee. I will move House File 5078 before the committee with the intention to lay over the bill for possible inclusion in an education bill.
Thank you, Madam.
And Representative Knorr, you can go ahead and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 5078 came about because of the funding that we got from the American Rescue Fund. Madam Chair and members, the ARPA dollars that were allocated to the Treasury was about $10 billion. And about $180 was allocated to the state of Minnesota. In 2021, part of our negotiation in how we should be spending the funds, we added in the jobs bill, which I was the chair, about $70 million for broadband connectivity. And then we decided that the rest should be spent in the guidance that were provided by the Treasury, which was connectivity in terms of providing equipment and gadgets to students, communities that have been impacted by the COVID-19 pandemic. But it also included a section whereby we can spend the money in multipurpose community facility projects, specifically for communities that have historically been left out and who have been impacted by the pandemic. So in that initiative in 2022, as I followed the resources, we negotiated to add additional funds for broadband connectivity, which was added to that bucket. So we had essentially spent more than 70% of that allocation specifically for broadband. Finally, I think the portion that was left out, last year Minnesota was allocated about $50 million for multi-purposes projects. The intent for the funds to carry out critical capital projects that will directly enable work, education, and health monitoring. Madam Chair and members, this is just trying to make sure that we keep our word when we say we will be spending the funds based on equitable distribution and making sure that we invest in communities that have been left out. It was more of an intentional choice to invest the resources in broadband, which is allowable under the federal guidance. But I think based on our persistence, we wanted to make sure that we can also provide resources to build libraries, community services centers that have really been impacted during the pandemic. So what this bill will do is make sure that we allocate the funds that were given to the state of Minnesota so that the local governments, the park boards, the schools, the libraries can receive that fund directly invested. At the same time, I just wanted to make sure that the intent of the guidance that we have from the federal government is to consider communities that have been historically been left out in such a project. And this will allow the funds to go directly to that purposes. Thank you so much, Madam Chair and members. This is just a simple bill trying to address a big issue.
Thank you, Chair Knorr. Members, are there any thoughts on this? Representative Clardy.
Thank you, Representative Knorr, for bringing this forward. Just a clarification, you said it's for groups that have historically been left out. Where are the funds right now?
Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Representative Clardy. Madam Chair, I think the funds are now through MDE. So the fund, initial funds went to Minnesota Office of Broadband Development. The last portion of that fund, almost $50 million, is now with Minnesota Department of Education, which is the jurisdiction that has the key state contact for the federal government.
Representative Clardy, follow up.
Just to follow up. So your ask is?
Representative Knorr.
Madam Chair and Representative Clardy, I think the ask is to make sure that all the negotiations that have been happening for multi-year, that we uphold what we agreed to do with the funds, particularly making sure that communities that have been left out are able to receive those funds for that specific purposes. At the same time, ensuring that the funds go to the governmental entities that are going to be responsible in ensuring that the funds applicable to the multi-purpose community facilities will go to them, so such as city, county, schools that can receive directly so that they can provide the critical infrastructure support as indicated in the guidance.
Thank you. Representative Spencer Mura.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Knorr, for bringing this bill. I'm wondering if we would be able to have a representative from MDE come up and share kind of what, from their perspective, what the status of the funds is.
Mr. Uni, please state your name for the record again.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Adosha Uni. I'm the Director of Government Relations for the Minnesota Department of Education. And Representative Sensimura, so that just to be clear, the question is just kind of what the status is currently. So as Chair Knorr had mentioned, it's been a multi-year application process with the federal government through the United States Treasury. And we had submitted our application sometime in late 2022 for these funds with our plan for the $50 million for community facilities projects for community to assist communities that are most adversely impacted by the pandemic, which we found have closely aligned with communities of color, indigenous communities, and low-income communities. It took about a year for them to approve our application, so we got approval last fall. And then we've been engaging in conversations with partners for distribution in the metro area and in greater Minnesota for the eligible projects. So those partners that we would be working with are Greater Twin Cities, the United Way, and then the Minnesota Initiatives Foundation for Greater Minnesota. And so right now we're currently in conversations with them about how to establish that. We were originally targeting for the grant opportunity to be open this spring, but discussions and logistics have taken a little bit longer than we've expected. So we're looking at late spring to early summer, somewhere around there for the grant opportunity to be open. The project timeline were the projects have to be completed by December of 2026, so the funds have to be expended for the projects to be completed. And then just for committee awareness, the projects for the intended purpose, and I have the list of what they can be used for, have to be used for those services that are eligible under the project for 5 years after completion of the project. They don't have to be used exclusively for those services, but they do have to fulfill those services for 5 years from completion of the building project.
Representative Spencer Murrow.
Yeah, thank you. And I'm wondering if you would be able to share that list with the committee.
Yes, the list of eligible. My apologies, Madam Chair. Representative Spencer Murrow, you're saying about the eligible uses. Yes, I just have this pulled up here. So the purposes, the general areas that they would benefit are education, workforce participation, health, focus on advancing family economic stability, and connections and educational opportunity for children and youth. So the eligible projects would be family resource centers, full-service community schools, libraries, and community centers. And again, all of those that provide services or activities that fall in education, workforce support, like helping find jobs, a health focus, so like a school-based health center would be an example of that, and then connections and educational opportunity for children and youth.
Thank you. Representative Spencer Murrow, any more follow-up?
No.
Representative Verding.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry, I wasn't here last session, so I don't know this as well, but I have a question. How much are the grants, are these matching grants, or like what? How much can they apply for?
Mr. Uni.
Madam Chair, Representative Vernick, the amounts I believe are up to $500,000 or $400,000. I'll have to get that exact amount. I haven't looked at the application for a little bit. That's not established in any statute or session law. I don't know. I don't think that this requires local match, but that's something that I'll have to come back and look at.
Representative Vernick, follow up.
No, thank you.
Representative Bennett.
Thanks, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Noor, for this bill. And Representative Clardy, you asked the very question I have is like, where is that money and why is it not being used? And I appreciate the explanation. And I get that by the way, I hope it's been in an account that it's least gaining interest, because that's a lot of money to sit without for that long. But I know the federal government's slow, and recognize that, but I hope that our state would not copy that and that we will be fast and efficient in getting these funds out, and so we can utilize this money, because as we all know, the buying power of money right now with inflation keeps going down the longer we wait. So let's get that money to work. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Bennett. Any other follow-ups? With that, Representative Noor, final comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I appreciate you hearing the bill and look forward to working with you all. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Noor. With that, House File 5078 is laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill, our education finance bill. Next up, we have Representative Liz Lagarde. Welcome to the Education Finance Committee again. And with that, go ahead and I will move House File 4986 before the committee with the intention to re-refer it to the Committee on Taxes. Go ahead and start your presentation.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members. I appreciate the time in committee today. Minnesota has a long history of supporting public education, but we've got a problem when a quarter of our schools, school districts, are falling behind with operating referendum To be fair, the operating referendum was supposed to be for extras, but we all know that dollars simply going to pay bills, cover student services, and to try and pay a competent wage for staff. The districts I'm talking about, a lot of them, they can't pass an operating levy. And now there's a lot of reasons why that is, but I'm startled when I look at the map, which I believe all of the, you guys have in front of you, and I see that most of these zero districts are in central and northern Minnesota, the same communities where there's a lot of seasonal and recreational property that isn't contributing to the local school operating levy. I understand that previous generations of legislators decided that these properties should stay into the state levy instead, but my bill doesn't change that at all. Important for that. What this bill does is bill creates a seasonal recreation tax-based replacement aid aimed at reducing local tax efforts required for voter approval. The bill does not give school boards additional levy authority, as the voters must still be asked to vote yes. This bill is especially impactful to school districts with a very substantial amount of seasonal recreational residential property. The bill would reduce the tax effort by as much as 50% in districts where the cabin market value represents a substantial portion of the total market value. Again, the bill does not change how cabins are taxed. With me today, I have Superintendent of Mesabi East, the school that is in my district. Jeff it brought this to me, and we've had discussions over a period of time. And what's important to know is we do have equalization. This bill is similar, but this is a new concept. And there is a fiscal note of, I believe it's $8.4 million. And I know that, you know, the targets came out as a chair. I know that that kind of, you know, narrows things in there, but this conversation needs to happen because there are certain school districts, there's 92 that can't pass an operating levy because we don't have the tax wealth. And the superintendent is going to read you kind of what the cost would be to pass the same dollar amount in different districts. So, Madam Speaker.
Thank you. Before we go to the superintendent.
Madam Chair, I just upgraded you.
Before we go to your testimony, I think we'll go to Mr. Strom to explain one of his lovely spreadsheets that he has in the packet.
Madam Chair, committee members, in your packet is a spreadsheet that's got a few pieces of information on it. It's a district-by-district list, and if you look at the second column in after the pupil units, that's the tax base that Representative Lislegarde mentioned that is used to equalize referendum levies. It's something we refer to as referendum market value tax base, and that's the assessed market value of all the property within that district, excluding two classes of property. The excluded property are ag lands, other than the house garage at 1 acre, and the seasonal recreational values. That's the next column that's listed, are those seasonal recreational values. So you can see on the total line, there's $843 billion of referendum market value. Another $43.5 million is seasonal rec property that is not included in that tax base. So what this printout does then is models Representative Lislegarde's bill. It shows the ratio in the next column of seasonal rec property of RMV to the new base if seasonal rec were to be added to it, creates the ratio the bill requires that shows the amount that would be paid, essentially the last column then showing the amount that would be paid if this bill were enacted, and the fourth to the last column shows that referendum allowance that Representative Lislegarde mentioned. You can see just at the first district listed, Aiken has not passed an operating referendum. As a result, they have an allowance of $0 per pupil. So on the printout, even though they're at 45% of potential levy reduction because they have zero as a referendum allowance and zero referendum levy, they're showing a zero impact. So the cost that's shown on this printout in the second to last column, $8.35 million, is the cost of this additional tax-based replacement aid, presuming no behavioral changes. If a district were to pass a referendum, you can use that last column to see the amount of the referendum levy that would be picked up by the new tax base replacement aid. So once again, the printout static and shows the impact on those districts that currently have a referendum and does not presume a behavioral shift.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. And with that, members, folks have driven a long ways to get down here, so I want to give them a chance to testify. We may be going a few minutes over committee time today. We've got permission to do that. And this is the one bill we are moving out, so please stick around. With that, Superintendent, please state your name for the record. Proceed.
Thank you. I'm Dr. Jeff Burgess. I'm the superintendent of Mesabi East Public School District. Thank you, Chair, and also the committee for hearing testimony. Couple things about our district. You know, you have the MREA map in front of you with a large disparity in districts that can pass operating referendums. There's also a large disparity in the resources that we can offer our students. When looking at my school district, we have a large percentage of low household income. We also have about a 50% free and reduced lunch rate at our district, which means 50% of my students qualify for free and reduced lunches. We have about 900 students. When looking at the tax base of my current district, about 30% of our current property is state or federal land, which means I have a large chunk of the tax base which is already out. Add on to that seasonal rec, and that brings my tax base pretty far down. So looking at, for me to pass an operating referendum in my district, a $500 operating referendum would bring in about $450,000 per year. Looking at how that impacts the taxpayers of my district, that would cost a $200,000 household about $168 per year. Now, in our region, that is a rather large hike in the amount of taxes. But looking at the differences between us and other districts, if you look at Duluth, to pass the same amount of referendum, it would cost their taxpayers on a $200,000 house $87 per year, and it would cost a Bloomington household of $200,000 $65 per year. So for me to pass a $500 operating referendum, it costs 1.5 to 2 times, sometimes 2.5 times, as much as other districts. So looking at that, there's quite a disparity in the amount of taxes per household to pass the same dollar amount per student. So with this bill, it would be a 20% reduction in the first $500, which would bring our dollar amount from 168 down to 134 as a tax impact for my taxpayers. Now, it's helpful. It'll help me get that through to provide the resources for my students. It's a step in the right direction. It's still a thing that we would have to pass. Now, looking at the impact on students, about $400,000 per year would do a long ways to help keep some of the resources that I've cut over the previous 3 years. In each of the last 3 years, I've cut about $400,000 from my district. Some of the cuts that we've made have been social worker, school nurse, industrial tech, elementary, English, choir, sped, check and connect, and numerous support staff. This is an issue that is very important to me. Getting any funding I can to help keep some of these positions is extremely important because I want to be able to offer the same resources to my students that other districts can offer as well.
Thank you, Dr. Burgess. And as a reminder, as we've talked about equalization in this committee, equalization is here for levies, but we haven't rebased it or changed it for quite a while. So districts like Dr. Burgess's, even that equalization is mostly going under the tax base instead of coming from state aid. With that, we'll go to our next testifier. We have Paul Petier, Executive Director from Range Area Municipal Schools. Remotely.
No,
so.
He's here.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming all the way down here. Dr. Burgess, if you just want to move over and we'll switch out as people have questions. Dr. Peltier, please state your name for the record. Proceed.
Upgraded. I'm not a doctor. I don't even
Director.
Play one on TV.
Director.
Thank you. Thanks, Madam Chair, and thank you, Committee. My name is Paul Peltier. I'm the Executive Director of RAMS, the Range Association of Municipalities and Schools, and I'm here on behalf of RAMS as well as the Minnesota Rural Education Association and my colleague, Sam Walseth. Together, we represent over 237 member districts in rural Minnesota, 15 of which occur on the Iron Range, and those are my home turf. One of the themes that you are the carriers of in this last legislative session, and this one, is fixing disparities, whether it's a rural disparity, an education disparity, a racial disparity, a financial disparity. That is kind of the mandate for the last year in this body. And we've heard the stories about the disparities that are coming to light as we exit the COVID era. And in Greater Minnesota, the financial disparity is especially glaring. And that's not only in Greater Minnesota. It is something that we see statewide in various economic regions of the state, and we would do well to pay attention to that. What we're asking for here through this bill authored by Rep. Lissegaard, and thank you, Rep., for bringing this bill today, as well as for all the stakeholders engaged, is to have a chance at a conversation. Right now, a lot of our communities are precluded from that because we just don't have the financial horsepower in our tax base to make that conversation happen. Equalization comes in many forms, and although this is a new conversation, this particular mechanism is a new conversation of the legislature and school funding, we believe it's an important one looking forward, and we're really grateful for the attention brought to this, and in honor that sometimes brevity is better, I'll leave it there. So thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Executive Director Peltier. Next up, we have Carol Lopp, seventh grade teacher from Grand Rapids. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Carol Kopp, and I teach seventh grade language arts in Grand Rapids. I'm here today in support of House File 4986 and would like to thank Representative Lissegaard for bringing this forward. A student's educational experience should not be limited by the zip code in which they reside. Students in Warba, Cass Lake, and Big Fork, to name a few, deserve the same educational opportunities as students in Edina, Bloomington, or Wayzata. Education funding must be fixed. While 70% of districts in the state of Minnesota have an operating levy, 30% do not, including Grand Rapids. The majority of the 30% that don't have an operating levy are in Greater Minnesota, as Representative Lissegaard mentioned. Last fall, my district had an operating levy on the ballot, and it failed miserably, which is when this conversation began. Greater Minnesota has world-class teachers, students, and programming. What it doesn't have is funding. When our referendum failed, we knew that we wouldn't have the necessary funding, meaning more cuts. Over the last 5 years, my district has cut $8.9 million, 43 teachers, 23 educational support professionals, technology, activities, transportation, the list goes on and on. Without funding from the state or a past referendum, I fear that my district, and many like mine, will continue to struggle. This bill would not fix all of our issues, but it's a start to fixing the funding gap that exists in Minnesota's often touted educational system. My students deserve a superior education, one without bandages and duct tape holding it together. They deserve an education where they don't have to sit in study halls for 2 hours each day due to lack of programming. Yes, I know, last year, districts received historic funding. However, chronic underfunding of education will not be fixed in 1 year. That money did not go to my class budget. That money did not go to hiring more teachers. That money helped slow the bleeding for one more year. Minnesota owes my students and students in Greater Minnesota the same educational opportunities that students in the metro receive. Please support HF 4986 so my district, like many others, can begin to rebuild. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Next up, we have John Ward, Brainerd School Board. Also on remotes, please state your name for the record and proceed. You might be having some technical difficulties here. Let's give it a second.
Madam Chair, can you hear me now?
Yes, we can.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Committee members, my name is John Ward. I'm a former state representative and also a former educator and coach of 34 years and a current school board member in Brainerd. I want to talk about the six districts in our area, Brainerd, Aiken, Pine River, Pequot Lakes, Pillager, and Crosby-Ironton, who are all talking about making substantial cuts due to the lack of funding. And we appreciate the funding that we received last year, as Ms. Kopp said. But the fact of the matter is, as she said, we can't create the funding that is needed in just 1 year. So I want to give you folks and I want to thank Madam Chair and the committee members, also Representative Lissegaard for listening to this bill and considering it. It is very, very much needed in greater Minnesota, as has been indicated, with the 92 school districts that don't have operating levies, but have most of them have high percent of seasonal rec property within them. So the cuts that our area is talking about looking at, eliminating classes, cutting curricular, extra and co-curricular, cutting teachers, increasing class sizes, cutting support staff, and that's really important, cutting support staff, especially teaching assistants. When we are looking at the READ Act, which is very, very critical in the state, you all know that. And one of the things that we can do with the READ Act, one of the things we need to do with the READ Act, is having teaching assistants in those K through 3 grades that will make an impact on the literacy programs. And so cutting support staff is really critical for educational journeys. We are going to look at cutting, schools are looking at cutting transportation routes and cutting transportation in general, cutting mental health services, guidance services, nursing services, cutting special programs that keep our students in our schools, like alternative education, career pathways, and other unique programs that we try to offer in order to increase our student population with a chronic and nationwide decreasing student population happening. We also want to make sure that we have classes offered that our business partners tell us are critical and important for them to have the employees that they need. Also is considering a redesign or a reassignment of early childhood programs, which are the programs that have the building blocks for future success of our children in their educational journey. There's districts that are looking at eliminating community ed directors, cutting coaching positions, combining junior and senior high activity travel, eliminating overnight travel, reducing co and extracurricular seasons. I mean, that's just a few of the cuts that are being talked about in our area and our districts, and that will be impactful for our students, our staff, our families, and our communities. And the last thing that I want to just point out that hasn't been talked about yet, while last year the legislature approved those that have operating levies are now going to be able to renew them without having to go back to the voters, that is wonderful. That is a piece that's been a long time needed, and we applaud the legislature for doing that. However, those of us in the state of Minnesota that do not have operating levies, we are going to create a larger financial disparity with those districts that do have operating levies and those that don't. So again, this bill is critical for those of us in the state of Minnesota that don't have operating levies, the 92 of us, and have a high percent of seasonal recreational property. We ask for your support for House File 4986. Thank you for allowing us to testify and tell you the importance of that.
Thank you, former Representative Ward and School Board member. With that, members will bring the questions to the table. Representative Sensenbrenner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Liz Lagarde. I don't have a question. I just want to say thank you for bringing this bill. I know that it might not be something that we can get done this year, but I think it's really important for us. I know there's different reasons why districts struggle to pass levies, but I know we've heard just a lot of heartbreaking stories about what that means for students on the ground. And so I think this is an important bill, and I hope it's a discussion that we can keep having in education finance.
Thank you, Representative Sensenbrenner. Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Liz Lagarde. I certainly understand why your schools are in the place they're at, and why you're bringing this forward. But I guess I'd just like to make a comment. What I'm struggling with is I heard those testifiers, and it breaks my heart. You know, having to cut mental health services, having to cut teachers, paras, all these various things these schools are under, and yet schools received millions of dollars, more than they've ever received last year. And so I guess the comment I'll make is this is needed, but it's needed because we put 65 new mandates on schools last year. It cost like $1 billion more for schools. So we put them in a huge place where I can understand why they're looking for any flexible dollar that they can. We have to be so careful what we do. We need to fix what we did last year, and this will help your schools. I want to help them. But my goodness,
let's stop putting money in one pocket and pulling it out of the other pocket for our school district. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Bennett. Representative Ream.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Liz Lagard, for bringing this bill forward. I really appreciate all the work you're doing to champion the areas that we don't think about a lot. When I was growing up, we spent a lot of time up north and really enjoyed cabin country and all the beauty that the northern areas provide, but we don't really think a lot about the kids who live up there. And so on a day like today, I think about, like, how do these kids get to school? You know, what kind of busing do they have? What's that like to be a kid up north? And I think, you know, we can't forget about these kids up in the rural areas, and I think it's really important that we are opening up this discussion. And the other thing I would say is, I think it was the testifier, I think it was Carol Kopp, who talked about how, you know, they'd have to cut this funding, even with all the funding that we did provide last session. You know, we can't make up for all the chronic underfunding in one session. So thank you so much for bringing this forward, and I look forward to seeing some progress being made.
Thank you, Representative Ream, and thank you, Representative Lisgard, for bringing this forward and the creative approach. And just a qualifier here, I keep hearing this number 65 being thrown around. That is an old number that started at the beginning of the session. More than happy to give you the list from MSBA myself to show you that it's fewer. So this kind of goes to say the number enough, and it sounds like it's true. But just wanted to correct that because we need to. With that, members, I think I'll give the final word to Representative Lisgard.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members, and, you know, I appreciate the dialogue and I appreciate the comments, but when you think about the 92 schools, it's not like they didn't try to pass an operating levy, right? And so that's telling, and right, so then when you dig down deep, why is that? And then how do we find a way to be able to help these schools, which is basically helping our communities? And so, you know, when you heard the superintendent say those numbers, right, 160 some to, you know, all the way down to down in the Bloomington, $69, there's no money up there. We don't have the wealth, but yet we have seasonal rec, and we're not raising taxes on nobody. This is a new aid, a new program. I think it's creative. I didn't come up with it, right? But I mean, I seriously, as we move forward, whether it gets across the finish line this year or not, we do have to be creative. We do have to find a solution to be able to help communities regardless of their zip code. And obviously the data is showing that in greater Minnesota, we're struggling more. So thank you so much for giving us the hearing and moving this bill forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Liz Lagard. And with that, I will renew the motion to re-refer House File 4986 to the Tax Committee. And you're on your way. And, we got a vote. That would probably be important. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. With that, House File 4986 has been re-referred to taxes. Now you are on your way. Members, we will be meeting tomorrow. I hope everybody has a safe drive home tonight. But we'll be meeting tomorrow. And remember, next week, we will be meeting on Wednesday and Thursday. We do not have committee on Tuesday morning because we don't start until noon on Tuesday. So see you tomorrow. And with that, we are adjourned.